Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. This is your election guru, Mark Braun here. Glad you could join us today. And I remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read in AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Right? Right. All right, this is presidential week this week, and we do have some things. Now, this is an interesting article that we've got here with regards to the recent controversial pardon for Trump with the January 6th insurrectionists. So, this is an article regarding some other past controversial presidential pardons. This is from the perspective section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, January 27, 2025. The controversial presidential pardons continue. Trump and Biden stir debate with clemency, a tradition started by Washington in 1795 by David Wharton. All it took was a few strokes of the pen for Donald Trump and Joe Biden to add to a long, strange American tradition. The presidential pardon dates to George Washington more than two centuries ago. Bestowed upon thousands and thousands of Americans since then, it remains a power both unique and highly subjective. Generally, presidents may pardon any federal crime, says Jeffrey Crouch, an assistant law professor at American University in Washington, D.C. Moreover, they may use clemency as often as they would like. This authority has led to controversial decisions, including reprieves for the likes of President Richard Nixon, officials implicated in the Iran-Contra affair, and disgraced commodities trader Mark Rich. The list grew a little longer in recent weeks, when Trump pardoned 1,500 or so January 6 rioters, and Biden did likewise for some of his closest family members. The history of executive clemency is also marked by examples that have slipped from memory despite being just as debatable or, in some cases, quirky. Here's a sampling. 1795, the Whiskey Rebellion. In the early 1790s, Pennsylvania farmers tarred and feathered several government officials sent to collect a new tax on whiskey production. As violence spread, Washington, in his second term as president, personally led a militia force to quell what became known as the Whiskey Rebellion. Washington decided to issue the first executive clemency in 1795, exonerating all persons guilty of said treasons. Though insistent on the rule of law, he spoke of the need to mingle in the operations of government every degree of moderation and tenderness. 1815, the pirate Jean Lafitte. During the War of 1812, British forces approached the notorious Gulf of Mexico smuggler for help in attacking the U.S. coastline. Lafitte not only warned American authorities, he and his crew proved crucial in defending New Orleans. As a reward, President James Madison pardoned them for any clandestine and lawless acts they might previously have committed. 1830, George Wilson. This case showed that not all pardons are created equal. President Andrew Jackson issued an executive clemency that spared Wilson from being hanged for robbing the mail, but did not preclude a lengthy prison term. Wilson turned it down. Startled authorities looked to the Supreme Court, which ruled Wilson had a right to refuse. Historical accounts regarding what happened next are murky. Some say he was hanged. Others suggest he accepted a subsequent pardon from President Martin Van Buren. 1858, Brigham Young. The Utah War of 1857 to 58 began when U.S. Army soldiers marched west to install a new governor for the territory occupied by the Latter-day Saints and their leader, Young. Though the year-long standoff was uneventful, tensions led to Mormons attacking and killing more than 100 innocent people in a wagon train bound for California. The war finally ended when President James Buchanan, facing criticism for what was known as Buchanan's blunder, pardoned Young and his followers for resisting the government. In return, they submitted to U.S. rule. 1868, the Confederate Army. President Andrew Johnson waited until 3 years after the Civil War to issue an Independence Day amnesty to anyone who participated in what he called the rebellion. Johnson justified the action as a means to promote and procure complete fraternal reconciliation among the whole people. 1971, Jimmy Hoffa. The infamous labor leader went to federal prison in 1967 for jury tampering, fraud, and conspiracy. Nixon tempered his the commutation of his sentence by demanding that he refrain from union activities. But declassified documents show the president's aides sought to use Hoffa to gain labor support for Nixon's 1972 re-election campaign. A few years later, Hoffa disappeared under mysterious circumstances and was never seen again. 1977 Vietnam Draft Dodgers. On his first full day in office, President Jimmy Carter issued a blanket pardon to anyone who had evaded the draft, allowing thousands of young men to return from Canada and other countries. It was part of his campaign vow to address the unfinished business of the Vietnam War. 1977 Tokyo Rose. It was 1941 when Ikuko Toguri, born in Los Angeles, educated at UCLA, moved to Japan. After the end of World War II, U.S. authorities charged the so-called Tokyo Rose, a radio handle she never used, with being one of several women who broadcast English-language radio shows meant to demoralize American troops. She was convicted of treason and sentenced to 10 years in prison. Nearly three decades later, after two prosecution witnesses said they testified under duress, President Gerald Ford granted her an unconditional pardon. 1989, George Steinbrenner, the bombastic owner of the New York Yankees, was convicted and fined, but not imprisoned, for making illegal contributions to Nixon's 1972 campaign. Years later, President Ronald Reagan issued a pardon that did not cleanse Steinbrenner's record, but did restore his full citizenship rights. 2001, Patty Hearst. The newspaper heiress who was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army and later joined them as Tanya was the recipient of two presidential actions. Carter commuted her prison sentence for bank robbery in 1979. Then President Bill Clinton issued a full pardon on his final day in office. That was the Controversial Presidential Pardons Continue by David Wharton from the Perspective section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, January 27, 2025. All right, on to a state that was solidly Trump's last year, Florida. From the Los Angeles Times, Friday, December 27, 2024, Florida star rises under Trump. Election results shifts power in the rivalry of Sunshine State versus Golden State by Noah Bierman, Washington. The rivalry between California and Florida reached a high mark in November 2023 when Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, faced up against Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, on Fox News over which state held a better model for the country. 13 months later, DeSantis has left the national stage after an aborted presidential run, but the state is winning the political war. The nation, under President-elect Donald Trump, will look far more like Trump's adopted home state of Florida after he defeated Vice President Kamala Harris by painting her as an out-of-touch California liberal. Trump is stocking his cabinet with Floridians, and his plans to reverse California's policies on the environment, crime, homelessness, and education are facing far less pushback than they did during his first term, thanks to the state's diminishing clout in Congress and a system of checks on Trump's power that has eroded. These are the folks born and raised in our state and are going to show America our type of leadership, said Brian Ballard, a powerful Florida lobbyist and Republican fundraiser, whose firm previously employed Trump's incoming chief of staff, Susie Wiles, and still employs his nominee for Attorney General, Pam Bondi, Florida's former Attorney General. Ballard's expanded footprint now includes offices in Washington and West Los Angeles, opened 2 years ago, another sign of his state's incursion. Other high-level Floridians are likely to be in Trump's inner circle, including Senator Marco Rubio, Trump's pick for Secretary of State, and Representative Mike Waltz, his choice as National Security Advisor. Two prominent people in Trump's orbit with California ties, advisors Elon Musk and Stephen Miller, are sharp critics of the state's business and immigration policies, which they have pledged to help Trump reverse. Their unified efforts are expected to unleash a continuation of fights that began 8 years ago during Trump's first term, when he sought to halt California's policies providing sanctuary for immigrants who came to the country illegally, slash its authority to set environmental policies such as automobile fuel standards, alter water policy to benefit farmers and suspend aid after wildfires. He was thwarted at many of those efforts by regulators, advisors who found ways to change his mind, courts, and former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the San Francisco Democrat who proved his most formidable adversary. Democratic attorneys general filed a record 155 lawsuits against the first Trump administration, winning 83% of cases, according to a tally by Paul Nolet, a political science professor at Marquette University. California was involved in more than 100 such lawsuits. But Trump has picked staffers for his second term who are less likely to push back against his wishes. The Supreme Court has grown more deferential to Trump, who appointed 3 of its 9 members. And Pelosi is no longer the leader of her party, while Republicans won control of both the House and the Senate in last month's election. California Democrats' best defense appears to be Republican dysfunction, as demonstrated by the party's struggles last week to pass a bill in the GOP-controlled House that would avoid a government shutdown. Trump, meanwhile, has vowed to fight the state, this time on a variety of fronts, including its homelessness policies, its resistance to a border wall, its electric car mandate, and his plan to begin mass deportations that would disproportionately affect California, a border state with the nation's largest Latino population. Newsom, who declined an interview request, has vowed to continue the fight against Trump's policies, but without what he called a resistance brand that defined his earlier clashes. Other Democrats have approached Trump's second term with more conciliatory rhetoric as the party struggles to coalesce around strategy. Former Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat who helped define the party's liberal wing for decades, argues that Trump will incite his own backlash by overreaching. "Bring it on," she said. "People just decided they weren't feeling happy about things," she added. "They didn't vote on the issues that are now going to hit them in the face," she said, citing a list of policies from Trump's allies that could lead to workers losing overtime and residents losing breathable air. But even if Trump's policies help Democrats politically, they may have a deep impact on Californians. Attorney General Rob Bonta, who began preparing potential lawsuits months before the election, said he expects to battle the incoming administration over immigration, climate, reproductive rights, gun safety, democracy-related issues, and civil rights. He acknowledged the Supreme Court's rightward term, but pointed out that most decisions are made by trial and circuit court judges. "We can and will prevail, and we have prevailed in front of the U.S. Supreme Court," he said. Bonta, who was considering a run for governor in 2026, argued that voters were choosing Trump, the man, narrowly, rather than a single state's government model. "The Florida model? You mean Matt Gaetz or DeSantis or Pam Bondi?" he said, referring to the former House member who withdrew from consideration as attorney general over allegations of sexual misconduct with minors, along with the governor and current attorney general nominee. "I don't think they're a model for the future of the country. What else is the Florida model? Don't say gay? Just absolutely exclusionary and discriminatory? A former program sending immigrants across the country as political pawns?" But Bonta and other Democrats concede that the party just lost an election and that Trump, even as he lost California by 20 percentage points, gained about 10 percentage points over his 2016 and 2020 margins in the state. Much of that growth came from among the state's Latino population, which makes up a large portion of Democrats' traditional working class base. "It's all centered around affordability. California is the least affordable state where you factor in housing costs," said Mike Madrid, an anti-Trump Republican pollster who conducted surveys of Latino voters after the election and has focused on their evolving views for decades. "The idea of California values is specific to cultural issues. It is essentially ignoring economic issues." Madrid pointed to policies like Newsom's plan to phase out sales of new gas-powered vehicles by 2035 as an example of a policy that does not speak to working-class voters. "Most Latinos in the state have to live farther from their jobs because of the high cost of housing and pay for more gas, but they cannot afford a new EV or benefit from a Biden administration rebate. The majority of their income is spent on housing costs, which have grown in part because of costly building regulations." New census estimates released last week show California gaining 232,570 residents between 2023 and 24 after pandemic-era declines. But the state lost more residents, 239,575, to other parts of the country than any other state, and saw an increase only because of immigrants from other countries, according to the estimates. Florida's population gain was among the largest, 467,347 residents, comprising both immigrants and domestic migrants. California's long-beleaguered Republicans are gloating as they promise to work with Trump to dismantle the Democratic-led projects and environmental regulations. Representative Vince Fong, a Bakersfield Republican who won an election to succeed former Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy earlier this year, said he will file legislation to halt funding on California's high-speed rail project and work with Trump to build a border wall in the state, blaming a porous border for allowing fentanyl smuggling from China. In an interview, he praised Florida effusively as a better model for business, regulation, environmental policy, and housing costs, and welcomed the state's influence at the national level. It's ironic to me that Governor Gavin Newsom and the Democrats in the state legislature are now concerned about affordability, he said. You hear them talking about it, but it's their policies. He accused Newsom of waging war with Florida and the Trump administration for his own personal gain. He is trying to elevate himself for his own political purpose and at the expense of Californians, he said. Newsom's office said the state maintains the world's fifth largest economy and ranks first in new business starts and private sector jobs. Brandon Richards, a spokesman, said Newsom is traveling the state to expand economic opportunity. But many of the nation's biggest business titans are making their own pilgrimage to visit Trump at his home in Florida. That was Florida's Star Rises Under Trump by Noah Bierman from the Los Angeles Times, Friday, December 27, 2024. All right, moving on. This is from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, January 31st, 2025. Surprise, women are still less fond of Trump. Why President's acts aren't helping with his gender gap, according to a recent survey by Anita Chabria. The whirlwind continues. On Wednesday, the White House backed further away from a sweeping and potential devastating freeze on federal funding for just about everything, rescinding a Monday memo that led to a Tuesday court injunction after dozens of states sued. Are you lost yet? But also, just after rescinding that memo, the White House said it wasn't really stopping the freeze, just maybe trying to sidle around the court's injunction. This is not a rescission of the federal funding freeze. It is simply a rescission of the OMB memo. Why? To end any confusion created by the court's injunction. The president's EOs on federal funding remain in full force and effect and will be rigorously implemented. Caroline Levitt, the new White House press secretary, said on the former Twitter, referring to President Trump's executive orders and the Federal Office of Management and Budget. Which is basically, we're going to do it, just not tell you we're doing it, even though we did tell you, but now we've untold you, so you can't stop us. To which courts replied, that's not how that works, and put a restraining order on the whole mess. So here we are, 11 days in, with a president who apparently really wants to save a few dollars by slashing Meals on Wheels, domestic violence shelters, low-cost child care, and maybe even Medicaid. That doesn't even touch on his other actions, including an internment camp for undocumented folks at Guantanamo Bay, which Trump announced Wednesday, the signing of the Laken-Riley Act, also Wednesday, which allows undocumented people to be detained for simply being charged, not convicted, of crimes such as shoplifting, the first day of confirmation hearings for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., where Senator Bernie Sanders pointed out that if Kennedy is no longer anti-vax, maybe his old organization should stop selling anti-vax onesies for $26 a pop. Elon Musk storming into the Office of Personnel Management, basically HR for the government, and seemingly taking over, and Twitter style, attempted to get rid of a large chunk of employees. Remind me what office we elected him to? Two executive orders restricting rights and treatment for transgender people, one trying to end gender-affirming care for minors, and one banning transgender people from openly serving in the military. And literally before I could finish typing this, another order demanding patriotic education in public schools and seeking to wipe civil rights from our history books by banning discriminatory equity ideology. I have my opinions on all this, and you have yours. What does America think? Unsurprisingly, Republicans are loving this stuff, and Democrats are hating it. In a survey of the president's first few days in office, a Quinnipiac University poll found that 85% of Republicans approve of the way Trump is handling things, while 86% of Democrats do not. Anyone who thinks there is a middle ground left in America is delusional. But I have to wonder if that split hasn't seeped into our households more than we think. The political division Quinnipiac found didn't interest me as much as the gender divide. Women do not like Trump. They do not like him in a house. They do not like him with a mouse, even one blended up by RFK Jr. The poll found that the majority of women across party lines don't approve of Trump or that litany of actions. While 55% of registered male voters across parties said they approved of the way Trump is handling his job, 53% of registered female voters do not. That same tilt was found when men and women were asked if their opinions of Trump was favorable or unfavorable. There, 57% of men held a favorable view, while 55% of women held an unfavorable impression. Quinnipiac polling analyst Tim Malloy told me there was a similar gender split during Trump's first term. But still, enough women, especially young women, voted for Trump to put him back in office. In fact, women supported Biden in 2020 more than they did Kamala Harris in 2024. An analyst of voting data from Navigator Research found that women voted for Harris by 6 points, 51% Harris to 45% Trump, a 4-point swing from 2020 when Biden won these voters by 10 points. Which, although Trump can't yet legally run for a third term, means women's votes do matter. Since Democrats seem entirely incapable of messaging anything coherent to voters these days, the future of America is largely left not to those they can pull away from Republicans, but to those whom Republicans alienate so badly that there's no going back. Which brings us back to that laundry list of Trump policies. Malloy, the analyst, said that those policies may be hurting Trump when it comes to women's opinions because a lot of them hit on issues of family. For example, 55% of women Quinnipiac talked to disapproved of how Trump is handling immigration. 57% of men approved. The January 6 pardons, a full 67% of women disapproved on birthright citizenship. 65% of women said we should keep it. Birthright citizenship, in particular, Malloy said, has great resonance with women. And if women dislike Trump, they like even less some of the other men he's surrounding himself with. Take Mr. Musk. Elon Musk is deeply unpopular with women, Malloy said. Tell it to his baby mamas. When it comes to the tech titan turned government slayer, 64% of women in the poll didn't approve of him playing such a prominent role in the White House. Nobody else has gotten that low in number, Malloy said. Well, we haven't done all the cabinet members yet, but that's a bad number. Trump has come into office doing exactly what he promised to do, which has made his party and apparently the majority of male voters happy. But for women wondering whether their elderly parent will be able to go to the doctor this month or if their child's Head Start program is about to close, that bright, shiny object is looking a bit tarnished. Democrats spent a lot of time during the campaign worrying about men, the young in particular, and whether the party was meeting their expectations. Now Democrats might want to start speaking to women. Because disruptors may seem great when they're crushing things you don't like, but it's entirely different when they take a club to things you need. That was Surprise, Women Are Still Less Fond of Trump by Anita Chabria, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, January 31st, 2025. All right, we have a few other Jimmy Carter tribute articles, starting with this opinions section article from the opinions section of the Los Angeles Times, Tuesday, December 31st, 2024. Carter's second term was not in the White House. Another 4 years as president would have been far less fruitful than as later faith-filled four decades by Randall Balmer. At a campaign event in Winston-Salem on the eve of the 1976 North Carolina Democratic primary, a voter asked then-candidate Jimmy Carter whether he was a born-again Christian. Carter, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher, replied that yes, he was born again, thereby sending a legion of journalists from outside the Bible Belt to their Rolodexes to figure out what in the world he was talking about. Carter sought throughout his life to act on the principles of his faith, which was defined in part by the extraordinary activism of 19th century evangelical Christians who worked assiduously on behalf of those Jesus called the least of these. They were involved in peace crusades and helped to organize public schools so that the children of those less affluent could become upwardly mobile. Northern evangelicals worked for the abolition of slavery. They supported prison reform and women's suffrage. Carter's progressive evangelicism was very much in that tradition. He was sensitive to racial inequalities from a young age and tried to address them as a school board member, as governor, and as president. He supported women's equality, including the proposed Equal Rights Amendment. As president, Carter tried to nudge American foreign policy away from its reflexive Cold War dualism toward an emphasis on human rights. He recognized that if the United States were to have any meaningful relationship with Latin America, we needed to attenuate our colonialism, so he pushed through ratification of the Panama Canal treaties. He advanced peace in the Middle East farther than any of his predecessors or successors, and he appointed more women and people of color to federal office than any previous president. Many environmentalists consider him the best president ever for their cause. Carter's failure to win re-election in 1980 devastated him. He departed from Washington for Plains, Georgia at 56, the youngest president to leave office since William Howard Taft. Rosalynn was especially embittered by the election loss. In one of her interviews decades after the 1980 election, Carter told me that in the course of his frequent reassurances to his wife that they still had productive years ahead of them, he began to believe his own rhetoric. He also conceded that if he had been president for four more years, that second term would not have been nearly so fruitful as the alternative turned out to be. Carter's post-presidency began with a middle-of-the-night idea. In addition to a presidential library, Jimmy told Rosalynn, we can start an adjacent institution, something like Camp David, where people can come who are involved in a war. I can offer to serve as a mediator in Atlanta or perhaps in their countries. We might also teach how to resolve or prevent conflict. This would be an entirely new model for out-of-office presidents, a privately funded nonprofit center to advance his goals and allow him to address issues he would have pursued if he stayed in the White House. In a list of basic principles for the center, Carter stipulated that it would be nonpartisan and that it would not duplicate the programs of other institutions such as the United Nations. Most important, Carter wanted an action agency, an institution devoted to change rather than simply theoretical or academic analysis. The Jimmy Carter Presidential Library and Museum, along with the Carter Center, was dedicated in Atlanta on October 1, 1986, Carter's 62nd birthday. His faith undeniably informed every effort at the center. Carter told an interviewer in 1988 that the life of Jesus had always been his guide. I don't see any disharmony in this life between evangelistic effort on the one hand and benevolent care of people who suffer or are in need on the other, he said. I think they are intimately tied together. Carter understood problems afflicting the world as spiritual changes in part, noting that industrialized Western society had failed to adopt Christian principles of concern and caring. He believed that people of privilege, especially people of faith, bore a special responsibility for those less fortunate, for those who suffer and are deprived. That's where Jesus spent all his ministry, Carter said. Piety alone wasn't sufficient. Followers of Jesus must live out their convictions with acts of charity. Early on, Carter identified access to healthcare, including mental health care, one of Rosalynn's concerns, as a fundamental human right. Noting at one point that 40,000 children die every day from preventable diseases. Using education and simple, low-cost methods, the Carter Center's health initiatives addressed neglected tropical diseases, lymphatic filariasis, trachoma, schizomyosis, and malaria. Other programs targeted guinea worms at river blindness on onchocerciasis. Extraordinary initiatives that have achieved near eradication of those diseases in regions where the Carter Center has been active. Peace and conflict resolution, the second focus of the Carter Center, built on Carter's success in negotiating the Camp David Accords. We need to deal with other people with mutual respect, Carter told an audience at Messiah College in 1988. And through that kind of approach, there can be peaceful resolution of differences through the use of diplomacy and negotiation, not through the use of military power. The center conducted programs on democracy and human rights and monitored elections in dozens of countries. Carter leveraged his relationships with world leaders to mediate various disputes, including those in Guyana, Ethiopia, and Serbia. In 1994, Carter convinced Kim Il-sung to open North Korea's nuclear reactors to inspectors. In Haiti the following year, U.S. military planes were headed toward the island, where Carter, together with Colin Powell and Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, persuaded the militant military junta to abandon power. Carter's persistent efforts at conflict resolution, dating back to the Camp David Accords of 1978, were recognized with the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. Jimmy and Rosalind, who died in November 2023, extended their public service beyond the Carter Center too, most notably with Habitat for Humanity, which Carter once described as the most practical, tangible way I've ever seen to put Christian principles into action. During one of our conversations, Carter choked up when he told of completing a house for a woman and her family who had been living in an abandoned septic tank. Carter's alternative second term lasted for more than four decades. One of the ashes of political annihilation, he became not just an elder statesman and world-renowned humanitarian, but arguably the most consequential of modern former presidents. James Laney, former president of Emory University, partner of the Carter Center, offered the best and most succinct characterization of the man from Plains. Carter, Laney remarked, was the first president to use the White House as a stepping stone. That was Carter's Second Term Was Not in the White House by Randall Balmer from the opinion section of the Los Angeles Times, Tuesday, December 31st, 2024. Randall Balmer, a professor of religion at Dartmouth College, is author of Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. Here's one more from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, January 1st, 2025. The right candidate, if not president, for the time. Before and after his disappointing term in the White House, Jimmy Carter truly shone, by George Skelton in Sacramento. Jimmy Carter was the right presidential candidate for his time in 1976. A smiling, homespun, anti-Washington outsider promising truth and decency. He was a natural populist, but he appealed to voters' better angels, not just the worst their worst natures. He preached love, not hate. That's how I remember the former governor and peanut farmer from Tiny Plains, Georgia. I covered him up close from his January campaign in living rooms and on street corners in the Iowa caucuses through the July Democratic National Convention, where he captured the party's presidential nomination. But he may not have been the right president for the time. America was hit with astronomical inflation, up 14%, that made what the country had gone through over the last 2 years seem like an economic boom. Mortgage interest rates neared 16% in some places. Moreover, his 1980 re-election prospects were doomed after Iranian revolutionaries seized 52 American hostages from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, and the Carter administration embarrassed itself with a failed rescue attempt. The Democratic president came across to many voters as naive and in over his head in sharp-elbowed Washington. This, despite his orchestrating a historic peace pact between the leaders of Israel and Egypt at Camp David. On the 1976 campaign trail, Carter's stock speech included this solemn declaration. I want a government as full of compassion and decency and openness and honesty and brotherhood and love as are the American people. In 1980, Republican candidate Ronald Reagan turned that against the incumbent and found a receptive audience. Mr. Carter did not give us a government as good as the people. He gave us a government as good as Jimmy Carter. And we know that isn't good enough. Reagan won an Electoral College landslide. But Carter became arguably our greatest ex-president with his humanitarian and diplomatic contributions. Throughout his life, he was highly energetic and tenacious, practically to the end. I wrote a Carter obituary column nearly 2 years ago when he entered hospice care after deciding to forego additional medical intervention for melanoma that had spread to his brain and liver. Then he held on until Sunday at age 100. In 1976, Carter offered a fresh face and breath of clean air to cynical voters who had lost respect for the presidency over Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal and lies told to them about the Vietnam War by Nixon and predecessor Lyndon Johnson. "My name is Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president," the initially little-known candidate began each stump speech, always with a folksy grin. He was running against a crowded field of more established contenders that eventually included California Governor Jerry Brown. Carter would immediately follow with this: "My wife, Roslyn, and I have been married 29 and a half years. She's the only woman I have ever," loved. Frankly, I thought that was this was a little weird, that he felt it necessary to tell voters that he had loved only one woman. But voters apparently ate it up. He won the contest after contest and ultimately ousted incumbent Gerald Ford. No rival could out-campaign him, and he was always accessible to the news media, never afraid to banter with reporters. In the early days, he traveled 100 miles to be interviewed by one small-town newspaper reporter. "One time I came across him standing alone on an Iowa street corner. 'Stay here, George,' he told me. 'I'm going to call a press conference.' He walked to a payphone, dialed an aide, and soon a few television and newspaper reporters showed up." Later, in the Illinois primary, Carter showed that he could schmooze with powerful machine bosses, namely Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley. In Iowa and New Hampshire, Carter had attacked political pros, but in Chicago, he developed a strong alliance with boss Daley. I vividly recall Carter, Daley, and actor Mickey Rooney walking side by side leading Chicago's lavish St. Patrick's Day parade the day after the Georgian won the Illinois primary to become the undisputed front runner. But Carter never changed his rhetoric, always using plain talk and avoiding fancy words. "What the voters are looking for," he told the TV interviewer, "is someone who can run the government competently, who understands their problems, and will tell the truth. We're not dealing with ideologies this year." Another trademark line of his standard speech: "I will never mislead you. I will never tell you a lie." But truthfully, he confused many people with contradictions about where he stood on issues, including abortion and busing to integrate public schools. In Iowa, after Carter won the caucuses, the state Democratic chairman, who was neutral in the race, was asked whether he thought voters misunderstood the candidate's position on abortion. "Misunderstood it? Carter has three different positions on it," the party leader replied. Campaigning in the Wisconsin primary in Milwaukee one morning, I heard Carter espouse one position on school busing that seemed to please a predominantly black church congregation. Then, at noon, speaking to white voters at a bowling alley, he got nods of approval by asserting that busing should be voluntary and locally controlled. Whatever, it worked politically. Carter loved to show off his charming hometown of Plains, population 683. One unforgettable day, I covered him there. Local folks had gathered around a loading dock to watch reporters sitting in swings and rockers while querying the future president. A freight train interrupted. We'll have to wait until the train goes by," Carter said. "But it's not a frequent occurrence, but it's the custom in Plains to watch the train go by." Voters were attracted to Carter's down-home style and grin back then. Would they be today? Probably not. Sadly, we're too polarized and jaded half a century later. That was "The Right Candidate, If Not President for the Time," by George Skelton in Sacramento, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times for Wednesday, January 1st, 2025. And folks, that will do it for this edition of Voter Information. So for all of your election needs and election candidates in the city, the state, and the nation, find it all right here. Until next time, everybody, this is your reader and host and election guru, Mark Braun. Happy voting and peace.